So friends, the topic for today's evening, this evening, is personality and individuality. Let's take an example of Viktor Frankl, who was an Austrian psychiatrist and a Holocaust survivor. He was in the concentration camp and went through very trying circumstances in the midst of great personal loss of everything that a man holds as valuable, as dear. But while he was going through this very difficult time, in the midst of those circumstances, he had a realization. He found that actually external circumstances cannot control our inner attitude. He writes about this, I'll just read a small quotation. He says, I quote, "Man is not fully conditioned and determined, but rather determines himself, whether he gives in to conditions or stands up to them. In other words, man is ultimately self-determining. Man does not simply exist, but always decides what his existence will be, what he will become the next moment. Every human being has the freedom to change at any instant. How can we dare to predict the behavior of man? We may dare to predict the movements of a machine, of an automaton. More than this, we may even try to predict the mechanisms or dynamisms of the human psyche as well, but man is more than psyche," unquote. Take the example of Epictetus, who was a great Stoic philosopher, but his external conditions were such that he was a slave, always in chain. Now he was slave to one called Epaphroditus. Now this fellow Epaphroditus was used to get some strange pleasure out of harming others. So he would twist the leg of Epictetus, cause him great pain. And there is a legend about how Epictetus became lame or used to limp all the time. It seems that one day his master Epaphroditus would torture Epictetus and twist his leg. In the midst of that great pain, Epictetus had that power to remain apart from his experiences, and with great composure, calmness, quietness of this mind of a philosopher, he would endure all that. And one day when this was going on, he warns Epaphroditus that, see, my leg will break away, my leg will break, don't do this. So the fellow still continues, and when the leg finally gives way and breaks, he says, "There, did I not tell you that it would break?" So with complete calmness, quietness, he would endure all this, which goes on to show that you may be chained physically, you may be a slave, or you may be in a circumstances which is entirely opposite to your ideals that you hold in your workplace and so on, but still you can internally remain free. That power is there in man. And take your own life experiences and examine it. You will find that you always have that power to respond and not react to circumstance. You have the power to be a witness. In fact, there is always a part of our consciousness which is witness, which is the perceiver, experiencer, and does not get involved in emotions and experiences and so on. We all have that power. So, what is this power? And what is the real identity of man? Are we these experiences and the one who seem to be involved in it? Or are we that portion of us which stands apart, which has the power to extricate itself and stand apart? such the question. In the Mundaka Upanishad, this is very beautifully illustrated. There is a story in the third canto, probably in the third canto. It says that there were two birds living together in the same tree, and the story goes on. I'll just read these two verses which give the story. Two birds living together, each the friend of the other, perch upon the same tree. Of these two, one eats the sweet fruit of the tree, but the other simply looks on without eating. When it beholds the other bird, the adorable lord, it realizes its own glory and gets freed from sorrow. This is what the verses say. So two birds, the one on the lower branches keep on hopping from this fruit to that fruit, sweet, bitter, and so on. But the other one does not eat. It is simply a witness. And when this the bird in the lower branch realizes that it is actually one with that higher bird, then it realizes that it is none of these experiences and reaches the end of sorrow. That's what the story says. So this is a beautiful way of putting across this truth, that there are these two selves in man. Actually one, but in birth it appears as two. Look at the word personality. Word personality, one of the etymological roots is persona. Persona means a mask. Personality, the name and form, Mr. So and so, and this body, the senses, and the personal consciousness, that's a mask. Individuality, the word, is derived from Latin, which says in plus dividus, which means not divisible. It's an indivisible part of us. So it speaks of these two selves in us. One is the clever lawyer, which seeks after pleasures, which, whatever be the circumstances, by hook or crook, ensures that we get that pleasure, we enjoy it. And then there is a voice of conscience in us, which says that, no, this is not right, you shouldn't be doing this. Most of the times we shut off that voice of conscience and give in to this clever lawyer who gives arguments as to why we should ensure that we get pleasures and avoid pain at all cost. Doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. So which is the real man, the identity of man? That's one question. But more important questions arise when you look at this whole journey which we undertake between cradle and the grave. Things, questions arise such as, why are we here? What is the purpose of existence? We are going through these various experiences. What is the meaning of all this? And in a few years we are all going to die. Then what's the use of all these experiences? What happens to all this? And then where were we before birth? What happens to us after death? These are some questions which arises in our mind, and if you look at modern science, which is materialistic, it does not even deal with these teleological questions. There is questions relating to the purpose or aim, meaning, does not even deal with it. Its realm is the five physical senses. So reality for it lies within the five physical senses. Investigation, research, progress, all is within the physical matter, realm of physical, material, physical matter. And so we cannot find any answers there. Looking at religion, we find that in its origin it is pure, but the way it is presently, it is like river Ganga. In the Himalayan origin, it is pure. But by the time it reaches Bay of Bengal and merges into the sea, there are all corpses and full of filth and pollution. So that's the condition of the religions today. Separated man and God, made God a separate being, and the whole life, what is all this? the will of the God, whims and fancies of the God, why all this sorrow and suffering? God has ordained it. It doesn't make sense. So we have to go back to the ancient science, wisdom, religion, which is both scientific and religious at the same time. There we have to find answers to this, these questions. And at the very outset, what do we find? We'll read this one verse from the Gita, which sets the context for further discussion, where Krishna says there are two kinds of beings in the world. I read this. There are two kinds of beings in the world, the one divisible and the other indivisible. The divisible is all things and creatures. The indivisible is called Kutashtha, or he who standeth on high unaffected. But there is another spirit designated as the Supreme Spirit, Paramatma, which permeates and sustains the three worlds. So the divisible, the indivisible and the supreme. This is the classification which is given, and we should hold on to this to understand all these various questions, to find answers to all these various questions we raised. This Paramatma or the Supreme Spirit is prevalent in everything. That is why the Sufis say that there is no difference between this world and the other world. In other words, the God is one. And if there is one God, how is it separate or apart from anything in the universe? How can you take only one thing and say this God is only here? So, this basic idea of which the Upanishads also say, in the Ishavasi Upanishad you find this. Ishavasya midam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam jagat. Which is, Ishvara is the everything. Everything that you can see, perceive, hear, past, present, future. Whole of the universe is divinity. Purusha Sukta also says this. Purushameva idam sarvam. The past, the present, future, all this is Purusha. Purusha is spirit. So, from this one flame or the one ocean, innumerable sparks arise. Innumerable conditioned consciousness. Or innumerable drops from the one ocean. Now, can you say that the spark is different from the flame? Definitely not. Spark is one with the flame. The same as the flame. Has all the potentialities, the powers of the flame itself. That spark may be caught up in the body of a criminal. The divine spark may be caught up in the body of a criminal or a merchant or an engineer or a politician or a sage. But then in its essence, the spark which is in the sage as well as in the criminal, in their essence it's one and the same. This is the primary which we must hold in our mind, which is why the Sufis very beautifully illustrate this. I'll just read a small poem. You all have heard this many times, but then we still have to read it once again, which is from Shabistari, Saduddin Muhammad Shabistari. He wrote this book, The Secret Rose Garden. He explains how in the smallest of the insignificant thing that we see, the potentiality of the highest is there. He says this: know the world from end to end is a mirror. In each atom, 100 suns are concealed. If you pierce the heart of a single drop of water, from it will flow 100 clear oceans. If you look intently at each speck of dust, in it you will see 1,000 beings. A gnat in its limb is like an elephant. In name, a drop of water resembles the Nile. In the heart of a barley corn is stored 100 harvests. Within a millet seed, a world exists. In an insect's wing is an ocean of life. A heaven is concealed in the pupil of an eye. The core of the heart, the core in the center of the heart is small, yet the Lord of both worlds will enter there. The same thing which Krishna said, so there is absolutely no difference in these teachings. Same thing which Krishna said, Paramatma, which is reflected in the hearts of all beings, or what the Upanishad said, is the same what the Sufi is saying, that in the hearts of each being is a resident divinity. And each of these parts, we may call them souls, or aspects, all these souls being aspects of one universal soul. Right? All these divine minds, aspects of one universal divine mind. It has to go through a certain pilgrimage through the world of matter. That is what we are all going through. This life that we are going through in body is a part of this pilgrimage. Pilgrimage to where? Your pilgrimage is starting from a place and reaching a shrine or a holy place. So we have all started from as sparks of this divinity, going through this cycle of matter through repeated birth and death, and we are on the way to merge back into that source from which we came. So, as Krishna says, it is even a portion of myself. When Krishna says myself, he refers to that Supreme Spirit. It is even a portion of myself which assumes life in this conditioned existence, draws together the five senses, the mind, in order that it may obtain a body and may leave it again. So that spark, which is our real identity, which gives us the power to stand apart from all experiences that we are going through, that is wearing this personality like a cloth. We wear this cloth, right? And tomorrow we discard it and wear another one. Similarly, the body, the senses, the mind are like clothes which our real self wears. And the question is, why is it that we are not able to perceive? Why is it that we are not able to recognize this? All the teachers say this, but we seem to think that we are this body. We seem to think, we have this strong conviction that we are this body. When something happens to us, we identify ourselves with it and either enjoy it or feel bad, and you know, all kinds of emotions arise in us. The reason is that part of consciousness in us is wrapped up in desires. Krishna says that this Purusha, when he becomes embodied in Prakriti, or the spark of divinity when he comes in contact with nature, body, and the three gunas, the desires and so on, it becomes deluded by these things. So there is a self-identifying attachment which arises in us to, you know, where we think we are this body, we are these circumstances, and so on. But in reality, this relationship between the personality and the individuality, or the name and form and the personal consciousness, the waking consciousness which we all have, which we are using now, and the root from which this consciousness arises, that relationship must be clearly understood. What is that relationship? It is like the relationship between a landlord and a laborer. A landlord owns large tracts of land, then he cannot go and plow everything and do the work, so he assigns a laborer. He says, fellow, look here, you have to go do these works, take care of the plants, the crop, ensure that it gets sufficient nutrition, and at the end of the season you need to bring back harvest. Right? That's the work of the laborer. And the personal consciousness, which is what we identify ourselves with, which we think we are, and that root from which our consciousness arises, that's the relationship. when a birth is to be taken at the moment of a new birth, this divine spark cannot completely reincarnate itself in matter. So it sends an efflux, a reflection into the body, which is this personal consciousness, the personality. And the work of the personality is to ensure that it brings sufficient spiritual harvest at the end of each season, at the end of each life. But whether we are doing that or not is the question. Generally what happens with our personal consciousness, we all have free will, and we use that free will to chase our desires. We are situated in the midst of desires and it looks very enticing. So we chase our desires and we struggle to obtain it and enjoy it, forgetting that the laborer is here not for his enjoyment but to do the work of the landlord. So this is called crucifixion in the Christian theology. We find about Christ being crucified on the cross, right? The actual symbolical meaning of crucifixion is this. If you extend your arms and stand, it looks like a cross. The body looks like a cross. The divinity in us is the Christos, or the Christ, the Krishna within us, the spark of divinity within us, which is our real nature. And Christ is crucified every day on the cross of the body through the nails of our passions, our anger, our desires. This is the meaning of daily crucifixion that we are doing. So what must be done? How do we bring about a change in this? If a plant has to grow, it needs sunlight. But if we keep the plant in a dark room, the sunlight will not come chasing the plant and shed light on it. The plant will have to be kept in the sun, where the sun shines. Similarly, we want light, vitamin D, for absorption. If we sit in the dark room, sunlight will not come chasing us and then shine on us. We have to put ourselves in the sun, right? Similarly, the personal consciousness, which has free will, which is our waking consciousness, what we are all using now, that has to stop being instigated and moved by desires, but instead it has to revert back its gaze towards its divine origin. So this can be very well understood, all these things, by knowing what happens after death. This is something important to understand, the process of death. See, when we say a person dies, what the first stage is, this physical body has become unusable as an instrument. So the thinker within the body gives up this physical body. And then that is not everything. That's not the end of the story. There is that another body, you may call, quote unquote, which is the body of desires. Just like we have fed this physical body and then it has grown, similarly we have fed our desires and tendencies, right? That also forms a body, metaphorically. And that also will be given up. That's the second process, second stage in the process of death, which we go through, which all of us have gone through innumerable number of times, which we will go through in this life also. What happens at that point is, just like when a harvest is brought, there is a separation of the grain from the chaff. The useless portion is removed and the golden grain is harvested, is taken right? The same thing happens at the end of the each life, wherein all our noble, spiritual, worthy, unselfish feelings and emotions and works that we have done is the worthy part. That's the only useful part of this life. That's the only spiritual wealth. That's the true Lakshmi. And all the chaff that we have done, our wealth, fame, power, all these things are a useless portion which has to be left here. So this separation happens, and that divine ego, or what we call individuality, takes this useful portion, most the cream of this life, if at all anything like that has been generated, is taken and assimilated. Kabir says this very beautifully in his poem. I don't remember the actual verses, but he says, the translation of it is, the wise one will take the cream, the butter, and the ordinary people will be happy with the buttermilk that is left, the non-nutritious buttermilk that is left. And look at this beautiful symbol of Krishna having this love for butter, right? We all read about Krishna being, Krishna's love for butter. It actually represents this. Krishna is that spark of divinity in us. And the love of butter, what is butter? With the churning that happens in the life, the very cream, the most spiritual essence of our experiences, most ennobling, unselfish feelings that we have generated, the concern that we have had for others, all that is the butter that comes at the top. So Krishna likes to take that, that's the meaning. In each end of each life, this process takes place. Next will be the process, the stage of assimilation of that. Now we eat the food for how many minutes? 15-20 minutes? That's what it takes us to eat, have a dinner or lunch. But it takes 4 hours to digest and assimilate it into part of our body, right? Similarly, the spiritual experiences that has been taken to this state, which is called heaven, Devachan, and so on, a condition, state of consciousness, that is assimilated over a long duration. So, how long will that duration be after our death, wherein there is a period of peace, rest, and very glorious spiritual state, where this is all assimilated? The duration of that period will be proportionate or exactly the same as the kind of the amount of such feelings that we have generated. It's all cause and effect, cause and effect. If we have not generated such causes in our life of concern for others, unselfishness, overcoming our defects, and the aspiration towards our higher nature, if we have not even generated any such energies, then that we won't even have that state. If there is no food, where is the question of digestion, right? So the our real self, which is beginningless and endless, is like a bee which goes from bud to flower and gathers the most sweet nectar, honey, gathered from each flower, and all the other material things are left by the bee. The bee doesn't take the flower itself. Essence of the flower is taken. Similarly is our real self. Our real nature is like that. We have gone through innumerable number of lives in the past, gathering experiences, and then taking up a body, gathering experience, giving up the body. So our real self is called Sutratman. Sutra is a thread. Imagine a beginningless and an endless thread. On it are various beads of varying brightness. More bright means there was more spiritual essence which was gathered from that light. Less bright, dull, useless. So from that perspective, if we see our personal life, great transformation comes, right? We see our relationship with others and how we react to others, all these undergoes a transformation. So this is another point. We describe this process of death, what happens post-mortem state of consciousness. Now that's not the end of just like we sleep tonight, that's not the end of it all. Tomorrow we get up, and then all the defects that we have today, the tendencies, desires that we have today, does not go vanish just because we slept and woke up tomorrow morning, right? Similarly, all the defects that were there in the past life will remain waiting for that divine ego to come back from that state of consciousness, high state of consciousness. When it is a time for it to reincarnate, all these come and attach and then form a new body, a new birth in a family with all the circumstances of life. At that moment, it is said that we see our prospective life, where, in what family we are going to be born, what will be the circumstances of life. Not only that, the causes for each of these things which we have sown in the past is seen, and the relation is seen. The effect is seen and the prior cause is seen. Which is why Plato says the very nature of soul is justice. So if only we were able to touch that consciousness in us, touch that divine nature in us, we would instantly see the justice of all the events of our life, all the causes in the past that has led to the events and circumstances of this life. We would not have a single breath of complaint, no grumbling. We would be happy to see that we are working out all the past causes that we have set, and see the life as a great opportunity. So the personality, the name and form, Mr. So-and-so, so-and-so, this personal consciousness is then an instrument of the divine. The real man is the actor. Every evening he plays a role. Today in the Shakespeare drama he is playing this. Tomorrow he plays Yakshagana with that, and so on and so forth. He is not none of these roles that he plays. He is the actor himself. Similarly is our real nature, which is beginningless, deathless, changeless, eternal, but constantly taking up bodies again and again to gather these experiences, so that in the end, finally, the instrument or this personal self, the personality, becomes a perfect instrument for the knowledge that is there within us, the powers that is there within us to express itself. That is the purpose. And in this context, we see that our personality is full of defects, right? So we are born here not because of our virtues, not because we are of sagely nature. We are born here on this earth because of our defects, and life is an opportunity to overcome those defects, to transform vices into virtues by killing vices and developing virtues. This is a very nice section in Dream of Ravan, which says that we are all born here because of the moral death that we have had. The physical death that we see around us is because of the moral death that is there. I'll read this portion, very, very enlightening portion. Here, sage Ananta is made to interpret the dream of Ravan, and in the course of this discourse, he says this: "O tragic man, whence is all this death in thy life? Alas, it is because an inward moral death reigns throughout all, that it must have this outward manifestation also. Men's souls are dead when they are born. This life is the autopsy, and the disease is made manifest to all. One died mad of pride, one frantic with anger, one leprous with sensuality, one had the fever of ambition, one suffered from the insatiable craving of greed, one from the malignant venom of revenge, one from the jaundice of jealousy, one from the eating cancer of envy, one from the surfeit of self-love, one from the paralysis of apathy. Many were the deaths, but death into this world the common result of all. Yes, death is triumphant here, death physical and moral. The dead bring forth the dead, the dead bear the dead to the funeral pyre, the dead walk about the streets and greet each other and bargain and buy and sell and marry and build, and know not all the time that they are but ghosts and phantoms. That land of silence and shadows, of desolation and ruins, of sorrow and death, in which thy soul walked in the vision, O Titan, is the world in which thy dead body now walks waking. Renounce and annihilate it, O King, by asceticism and divine gnosis, and thus return to real life." Ghosts and phantoms that are mentioned here, the personality. We think we are all separate because we work on the basis of our personal consciousness, which sees separateness. It is not enlightened. The light is not shining in our personal consciousness, therefore we see separateness. But if we were to transform our consciousness through development of virtues, so that it vibrates in resonance with our divine nature, not vibrate in resonance with desires. If we do that, then we begin to more and more see unity. Then, as Krishna says in the Gita, then the vision of such a one will be, he sees no difference between a mlecha, or a cow, or a dog, or one who eats the flesh of the dog. He sees the same divinity in all. How is this to be done? He is through doing our duties, by following our dharma. Look at the word dharma. With that, by saying this, we will end and leave some time for discussion. Dharma word comes from the root or dhatu called dhru. The definition is dhru dharayiti dharma, which means that which sustains, that which holds together, that which binds together, that which upholds, that which supports. What is it that supports this body? What is it that holds this body together? What is it that sustains this personal life and then gives up the body and then gives up the desires, goes and assimilates and then comes back? It is our divine self, divine nature, our individuality in the context of this story. That is dharma itself. So while we are doing all the duties of our life, we must hold on to this thought. We have various duties, right? As an accountant, as an engineer, doctor. These are all some roles. Then as a father, husband, son, as a citizen. But all these various duties of life are apprehended in the duty to our real self. So while we are engaged in these duties, we must have that in mind. which is the recognition that we are in reality divine beings. And from that plane, from that understanding, do the duties of life without neglecting anything. But the great difference between this such a person and the one who is involved in the world will be the question of motive. You may not be able to find any difference between this person who is so thoroughly engaged in doing all that he has to do, who appears to be so ambitious, and so on, which is just like any other worldly person. But the great difference, and this difference makes a world of difference, the difference is that motive. He does all that he has to do as a sacrifice to his divine nature. Krishna very clearly says that in the third chapter of the Gita, that all actions which are done apart from as a sacrifice to the self makes the actor bound by action. What is it that binds us to rebirth again and again, makes us take this body, suffer, enjoy and so on? It is our own desires. But to extricate ourselves is through doing the duties of life without hope of reward or the fear of the consequences. So here is where the true philosophy of life comes into great aid. Because the true philosophy of life will be like a compass during this in the navigation in the sea. It allows us, or it shows us, what is the right direction in which we have to proceed. Now, without this compass, what sage Ananta calls as divine gnosis, without that, then we are led by various currents. As the wind blows this way, we go this way. As the wind blows that way, our ship goes in that direction. So the more and more we begin to do this, the more our personal consciousness begins to purify, and we begin to see reality, which is oneness. Then all these various personalities will disappear. To such a person, differences of personalities disappear. He will have the vision that we are all like different small holes in the same lamp through which the same light shines. So that is the vision. And we'll read this poem of the same Sufi. With that we will close. And he says here, he describes this perspective that arises of unity among all beings, which is universal brotherhood. So he has completely overcome his personal self, selfishness, separateness, and he realizes, he sees that oneness. He says, I and you in quotes, I and you are but the lattices in the niches of a lamp through which the one light shines. I and you are the veil between heaven and earth. Lift this veil and you will see no longer the bonds of sects and creeds. When I and you do not exist, what is mosque, what is synagogue, what is temple of fire? So we can take up any questions or any...